Please the court. Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Shan Jeffrey. I represent Brandon Moore in this case. To presume, to suppose to be true without proof. A presumption, as the Supreme Court explains in Sandstrom v. Montana, is an assumption of fact that the law requires to be made from another fact or group of facts found or otherwise established in the action or proceeding. Your Honors, in over 14 years of practice as a criminal appellate attorney, I've never seen a more clear-cut case of constitutional error in jury instructions as I did with the presumed intent instruction in this case. If you read Sandstrom versus Montana, then I'm hoping that you agree that there are no material differences between that presumed intent instruction and the one at issue here. And then if after reading Sandstrom, you still have any doubt that the Supreme Court would have struck down the presumed instruction here, or presumed intent instruction here, then I invite you to reread the Francis v. Franklin case, which really clears away any doubt that this instruction also would have been held unconstitutional and reversible error. What those two instructions have in common with the instruction here is the word presume. And that is also what makes it erroneous and unconstitutional, no matter what language follows that word. In Mr. Moore's case, where the jury was charged with determining whether he knowingly killed the toddler, due process of law should have precluded the jury from presuming anything at all.
But the presumption, if I can interrupt you, Ms. Jeffrey, the presumption would be acceptable if the other instructions made clear it wasn't a mandatory presumption, correct?
Actually, I think Francis versus Franklin would disagree with that statement that you just made, because in that case, there was language that qualified the presumption, saying that it was a rebuttable presumption, and that still was not good enough for the U.S. Supreme Court.
What if you had an instruction, hypothetically, if it's a rebuttable presumption, but other instructions made it clear to the jury they may infer but were not required to infer knowledge from the fact that the defendant committed the acts? Would that then be distinguishing from Sandstrom and Francis?
Well, I think you just hit the nail on the head with your distinction between a presumption and an inference. And that is what the Supreme Court focuses on in both Sandstrom and Francis v. Franklin. When you use the word presume, then you go to the definitions that I was just reading at the very beginning of my argument, when really what the court means to say is infers, but there's a world of difference between those two words, and the use of presume establishes a legal presumption, where the use of the word infer talks about inferences that may be made from the facts, and that's always been allowed in criminal cases.
So I'm just trying to understand. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, yes. I was getting back to your question. So here, we do have a lot of language about what permissible inferences can be made, but that did not address the language in the presumed intent instruction at the very end, the final instruction that the jury got before it quickly came back with its verdict after having received this supplemental instruction that gave the jury permission to presume without finding that Brandon Moore intended to kill his stepson in this case.
So the question I was going to ask you, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Jeffrey, if I may, please.
Of course.
Let us assume, I understand you disagree with this, but let us assume for purposes of argument that this error was not preserved below. And we are looking at this from a plain error perspective. Would you walk me through the analysis of that from your perspective, please?
Absolutely. And I went into that extensively in my reply brief. So if I don't have enough time to go through every detail here, I would also direct you to my reply brief.
All I'd like you to do is to tell me how you think quickly each element of the plain error test is satisfied.
Okay. I believe it's clearly erroneous because the Supreme Court said so. It said so in Sandstrom and Franklin when it talked about how many federal courts had already abolished the presumed intent instruction from its jury instructions. And also, there had been cases, the Winship case and the ones talking about how you cannot have a presumption of law in criminal cases, But of course, after Sandstrom and after Franklin, it's even more clearly erroneous because you have at least two United States Supreme Court cases clearly on point saying that this is not acceptable.
You're saying clearly erroneous, you mean obvious, where the plain error standard is obvious, substantial, affecting the result. When you're
right.
Clearly erroneous, you're using as another word for obvious. Is that what we're
yes,
talking about?
It's obvious because it's been fully litigated okay. In the United States Supreme Court, and the judge should have been aware of those cases.
But I understand and take your point there.
Yes.
But we don't have a Colorado Supreme Court or a decision that's published by this court that says that, do we?
Well, what we do have in Colorado is we have the historic shift away from the presumed language in the very instruction that we're talking about.
No, I understand that, but I'm saying that there is no Colorado Supreme Court case and no Court of Appeals case that says Sandstrom says this, and we follow that. Is there?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, but once the Supreme Court says it twice, I'm not sure that we need one.
Well, I get that, but I guess my question is, when we're talking about obviousness,
mm-hmm.
and that means that it should be obvious to the trial court.
Right.
If there is no Colorado authority, are you saying that that doesn't matter for matters of obviousness, as long as the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled?
Well, the Supreme Court has ruled repeatedly, and then in cases published after both Sandstrom and Franklin came out, our state courts changed their language to remove the word presume and insert the word infer. And I cite to that in footnote one in my reply brief, where I trace the history of how this has all come about. And I think that the change of language in both the Liggett case, which is that case is the Colorado Supreme Court case out of 2005, where they insert the word infer an intent to cause the natural and probable consequences of unlawful voluntary acts. I think that is an acknowledgement of the shift and an acknowledgement of the obviousness of the unconstitutionality of the presumed language in that instruction.
So,
yes.
The argument that you're making, the unconstitutional argument, goes toward the count of first-degree murder, but it doesn't really affect the other count, does it? The child abuse resulting in death?
I have to agree with that, Your Honor. And the reason that I agree with that is because of the end of the presumed intent instruction, where it talks about acts knowingly performed. And so that qualifying language then applies the presumed intent instruction to any crime before the court that involves knowing acts. And here we have, we actually have both crimes involving knowing acts, although the second degree murder instruction involves either knowing or reckless mens rea. But we know the jury found knowing acts because they also convicted of the first degree murder, which requires knowing acts. However, the second degree murder charge does not require knowledge of the fatal consequences of the act, and that's what we're talking about here. It only requires knowing conduct, and that's why I think it's the presumed intent instruction is not fatal to second degree murder, but it is most certainly fatal to the first degree murder. If the court has no more questions for me on that topic, I'd like to go to issue two. Issues two and three apply to both the first and second degree murder convictions. Issue two discusses the trial court's error in allowing the toddler's treating physicians to testify that Mr. Moore intentionally injured and purposefully inflicted trauma. We're not sure what that means. It could mean fatal trauma. To his stepson, and that 99% of all physicians would agree with this assessment. But did the doctors have personal knowledge that Brandon Moore intended to severely injure or even fatally injure his stepson?
Can I interrupt you there,
Mr. Yes.
Because your time is limited. Here, weren't both the coroner and the doctor testifying based on their medical expertise? In fact, in cross-examination, they both specifically said that they can't testify to the legal meaning of intent or mens rea. They're testifying to you know, what they view from a medical standpoint. So both of them said, you know, this was non-accidental, in my view, from a medical perspective. Aren't there many Colorado cases that say that that's fine as long as it's clear they were giving testimony as doctors as opposed to a legal opinion?
I'll answer that, and then I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Of course.
I think the difference, Your Honor, is that it's permissible to say that, you know, from my expertise, from my experience, that these injuries are inconsistent with known cases of accidental trauma, or are consistent with what I've seen of known cases of non-accidental trauma, because that expert opinion only involves the state of the evidence before the doctor. But where the doctors here crossed the line is they said these injuries were non-accidental, and that means purposefully inflicted. That is a direct comment on mens rea, and it does not matter that they did not attribute that to Brandon more specifically, because this was not a case of identity. The identity was established, okay? Who else would they be talking about? No one. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jeffrey. You've got almost 4 minutes left for rebuttal. Ms. Friedman?
May it please the court, my name is Susan Friedman. I represent the people in this matter. My registration number is 34450. I would like to briefly comment on preservation. I think that is very important threshold inquiry in the analysis here of whether this is reversible error. And that is precisely why I included Appendix B and C, the transcripts of all of the discussion about this response to the jury question. I think that reading everything that was said, it's very difficult to come to the conclusion that the court was made aware that there was an unconstitutional presumption. Now, we can debate whether the word presumption itself is kind of a red flag, but in the context of the end of a long, emotional, difficult jury trial, none of these people noticed it. And the question is whether the court had a fair opportunity to correct the error.
Well, let's assume for purposes of discussion then that it's a plain error analysis. Ms. Jeffrey said that there were two Supreme Court cases that have clearly laid the law of the land, whether the Colorado Supreme Court has gone there or not, or whether this court in a published opinion has gone there or not. And therefore, it would still be plain error. How do you respond to that?
Well, that would go to the obviousness prong of plain error, but we would still have to discuss whether it was prejudicial, and that's where we disagree. We disagree essentially on the effect of the presumption.
So you are conceding that it was obvious as far as a plain error analysis was concerned?
I think in isolation, that question, you could say that the laws, but I mean, the case is from 1970, the other case is from 1985. Whether it's fair to hold the court to the burden of sua sponte noticing that is a less clear question. Whether it's fair to say the defendant doesn't even have to bring it up, you know, or alert the court to it, I think is another issue. But if we're just going on whether it was obvious, whether it existed in the law, sure, it was there.
So then perhaps you can address, I think, where you're about to go on in terms of prejudice here. I'm playing devil's advocate with you, of course, so push back. Here, the jury specifically asked the question, and I'm going to paraphrase, does knowingly apply just to knowingly commit the acts, or did he have to know that death was going to result? In response to that, the jury gets a long instruction that includes this presumption language. If the test is, do we think that that may, you know, reasonably possibly affected the result, how could it not? When the jury asked a specific question on that and is told, presume that if he knowingly committed the act, then he knew death was likely to result. How is that not prejudicial in that context?
Well, there's two ways. First, the presumption itself would only apply to acts knowingly performed. We know the jury knew that knowingly is a special word with a special definition because they just asked, how does it work with reference to these two charges? And the entire first couple paragraphs of the response say, for first-degree murder, the people, or, you know, these two things must exist. There's an objective factor of death must be more than merely probable. And we also need to know that the defendant was aware of the circumstances that made death practically certain. In the context of child abuse, it's just that the defendant's aware of the injury, that he was causing injury, the nature of his conduct with respect to the child. So they have it explained right there. So I feel that a logical person reading through the instruction, the presumption sentence, would say, yes, but only if it's knowingly. Well, what is knowingly? Well, we just asked that. Let's go back up to the top. For murder, knowingly is. And so it becomes just a circular, useless sentence, a tautology, saying basically, if you find that his acts were performed knowingly, which in this case means that he acted with an awareness that death was practically certain.
Well, excuse me for interrupting me. That's the key to the argument you're making. And I say this with respect, with all respect and mm-hmm. affectionately. How do you make that? You made a logical leap there, it seems to me. I get you can commit an act knowingly. I knew I was doing this. Mm-hmm. But then you presumed from that or jumped over and said the jury would have understood that meant you had to know the consequence as well. And that's the problem, I think, in this case. The jury had to find that Mr. Moore knew that death was likely to result, but they were told to presume that once they found the act was voluntary. You've made the connection that knowingly necessarily applies to both, and I'm not sure how you get there.
Well, I am presuming that the jury understands that knowingly is a term of art because they had a definition. It didn't help them. They asked for a supplemental definition, and they received it in the same paper. But assuming that they went with a sort of colloquial definition and just if he knew what he was doing generally, we must presume, that is my second argument, which is that if they presume that he was aware of the natural probable consequences, that's not enough to eliminate what has to be shown for first-degree murder to establish the element of knowingly, because death is more than merely probable. It's not the natural probable consequence. It is more than merely probable. Moreover, he doesn't have to be aware of the natural and probable consequences would have to mean that would have to be the same thing as the practical certainty of death. I don't think the natural and probable consequences of acts, and by the way, we don't know what the acts are, as opposed to Sandstrom and some of the other cases where the conduct, the killing was admitted, and it was simply the mental state. Here, it's very much, we're not sure, there was an accidental thing, and then there were other injuries inflicted and trying to keep the child conscious. And so we don't even know what the jury's going to find are the acts, but in any event, the natural and probable consequences of those acts, I don't think you can say establishes practical certainty of death. I think the jury has to find more, even if they presume what it tells them to presume, and they don't apply the right definition of knowingly. Presuming the natural and probable consequences doesn't get you there. It doesn't eliminate the burden of proving knowingly.
Pardon me for interrupting you, Ms. Friedman. I understand how your argument fits into the specific facts here, but I think that it creates a problem of further legal application. For example, if I were to point a gun at a person's head, knowing that it's loaded and pulling the trigger, the natural and probable consequences of that would be causing death. And I think I would know that. And so I'm concerned about the scope of your legal argument.
Well, we only need to concern ourselves with this case because I'm not up here arguing that this should be part of the standard jury instructions. The word presume is certainly problematic. And although that language appears in case after case after case, it's not appropriate to put in a jury instruction generally, as is a lot of case law. So we need to find out, in this case, did it prejudice the defendant? Were his substantial rights violated? Did it contribute to his conviction? And I don't think it did, because the error that's recognized by Sandstrom is relieving the prosecution of proving the mental state. And in this case, being aware of natural and probable consequences is not the same as knowing that death is practically certain. So it's not a one-to-one. In Sandstrom, it's intentional murder. You may presume he intended the consequences. We agreed what the consequences were. It was undisputed that he had done the killing. So it's very simple and one-to-one. But in here, we have the jury having to find essentially that natural and probable consequences is the functional equivalent of the practical certainty of death. And given that we're not even sure what they will find were the acts, I don't know it's as clear-cut as Sandstrom.
And I want to make sure I understand your argument, Ms. Friedman. In Sandstrom, I think you're suggesting that the acts or ordinary consequences of the acts was clear. But the instruction in Sandstrom was the law presumes that a person intends the ordinary consequences of his voluntary acts. Here we have the person's presumed to be cognizant or aware of the natural and probable consequences of his voluntary acts. I'm having trouble following the distinction, the distinction that you're trying to make. I get what I think you're saying, and push back if I'm misunderstanding, that it doesn't get the prosecution far enough. They still have to prove more than just you're cognizant of natural probable consequences. I guess your view is the prosecution had to prove what those consequences would be. Is that right?
Would have to prove not that he was aware of some amorphous consequence of acts that we're not sure. You know, we argue what the acts were, but that's disputed. That's up to the jury to determine what the acts are. But to prove it, you have to prove that he was aware of the circumstances, so not just the consequences of his actions, but also the circumstances that made death practically certain. So it's almost a twofold. The second step is twofold because there are circumstances, and then there is his awareness that death is practically certain. With respect to his conduct, there's a good definition in, I believe it's Mingo, explaining what consequences means in this context, and it involves the nature of the conduct and the circumstances surrounding. So I don't think just saying generally we presume awareness of natural and probable consequences of acts will satisfy the prosecution's burden of proving that he was aware of the circumstances that made death practically certain.
Why isn't it a problem when the jury specifically asks, do they have to prove that he knew that death was likely the result? And the court says you can presume that he knows the ordinary consequences from his voluntary acts, that it wasn't at least reasonably probable the jury would have relied on that to say, if we find knowing acts, voluntary acts, we can find that he intended what we, the jury, think are the natural and probable consequences, which they would say was death. I mean, for plain error, we have to find reasonable probability, not absolute certainty. And so why isn't that a problem?
Part of it is the order and the context in which it comes. It's not the only response. They didn't say, do they have to prove it? No, just presume it. Nothing else. They said, here's what they have to prove for this offense, and here's what they have to prove for the other offense. And then there's a little more explanation, and then it says, by the way, there can be circumstantial evidence. And this quote comes from the Keller case, where it was basically saying the reason why we can infer mental state from circumstantial evidence is because there's this universal presumption that people are aware of the natural and probable consequences of their acts. So it appeared in that paragraph of explaining, you know, by the way, there doesn't have to be direct evidence of his intent, as there almost never is. So I think the first thing you read answers the question, and the rest of the instruction is just giving guidance. That was the way the court explained it. It wanted to give them more guidance about how to use the evidence. So I would hope that the more positive statements saying the DA must prove one and two, that's what the jury would go by, rather than you can use circumstantial evidence and presume this, and it's not directly tied to the conclusions they have to come to.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to ask,
yes, there's a whole page of that supplemental instruction. It was a long one. What in the rest of the instruction clarified the, I guess I'm asking what I asked Ms. Jeffrey. I think you would have a strong argument if something else in the rest of the instructions told the jurors, you can make inferences and whatever, and you're not bound, this is an inference, not a presumption. I'm a little bit concerned I'm not sure I'm seeing anything in the rest of the instruction that tells them that. I mean, so you can tell them all day long, you can infer, but then if you tell them, but you must presume, it's a problem under Sandstrom, I think.
Well, certainly, if it had said infer instead of presume, then there would be no error at all. It's debatable whether it also told them they could infer or that it could be rebutted or anything, whether that would have cured it. But the question here is, did it operate to remove from the prosecution the burden to prove knowingly, as it is defined for first-degree murder? So it's not that it's not there, or I'm arguing that other language in the instruction would have mitigated it. I think even if you read it that way, it doesn't do what the presumption did in Sandstrom.
So you've made an elaborate argument in support of your position. Sandstrom's been out for a long time now, as you noted. Are there any other published opinions from across the country that agree with the position that you've been arguing today?
No, I didn't find any other cases that included the same language that we have, the knowingly performed, or that had the same mental state. You know, across the board, you have intent, intentional. Those are very simple concepts. Knowingly means something different in every offense, frankly. I mean, there's the result, there's the conduct, there's the circumstances. So obviously, it's just a lot more complicated. It's not a one-to-one intentional intent. So I didn't find anything really on point with this. My time is up. I would ask you to affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Friedman. Thank you for your patience with the court, and you're hanging in there. Ms. Jeffrey?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to first address the prejudice prong of the plain error analysis. This case had no perceiving witnesses except for Brandon Moore. There was no direct evidence of murderous intent. There was no confession. The jury could not reach a verdict on the first day of deliberations. We know that the jury was struggling with whether it even had to reach the question of whether Brandon Moore had a murderous intent because of the way it phrased its question during deliberations. The court could have just said to the jury question when it said, do we have to find that he meant to kill the toddler, or whatever the phrasing was, the court could have, well, first degree murder, because they phrased it in terms of first degree murder. The court could have said yes, and that would have been the end of it, right? But instead, the court gave this hugely long and elaborate explanation that concluded with the presumed intent language, and that presumed intent language was not qualified in any way. There was no instruction saying this means that you may infer, and it's even debatable whether that would have erased the effect of the word presume, but here we don't have to wonder because that was not included.
On that point, Ms. Jeffrey, can I ask you to respond to Ms. Friedman's position? She makes an eloquent argument, I think, you know, that even, let's assume, it says what it says. It doesn't say that they had that it presumed that it gets you to knowing that death was likely to result. It talks about presuming, be aware of the natural and probable consequences. Therefore, the prosecution's burden was not, limited or alleviated in any way. Could you respond to that?
If you're talking about the fact that she's arguing that the knowingly performed language sort of qualifies this in some way, is that your
opinion? I think that's part of it, but as I understood Ms. Friedman's argument, it says persons presumed to be cognizant or aware of the natural probable consequence of his voluntary acts. It would be different if it said you are to presume that he knew death was likely to result if he knowingly performed his acts, which would be a direct one-to-one. You get exactly what the prosecution had to prove, as I understood Ms. Friedman, and if I get it wrong, I apologize to her, that the presumed intent instruction didn't go that far. It just says presume the natural and probable consequences. It didn't say presume knowingly.
Well, I think that it's all encompassing. I mean, here with the first degree murder, the definition of the crime, you have to prove that both that conduct was knowing and the practical certitude that death would result. I mean, that's just in the definition of the crime itself. And so when you're looking at the presumptive language of consequences of acts, here the consequence was fatality. So I think it does directly speak to the fatal consequences of the acts. And it was in direct response to the jury question asking whether they had to make that specific finding, whether he had to know at the time of the injury that the actions would prove fatal. And so I think if you look at it in the context of all of that, it does speak directly to the fatality. I also just want to say very briefly that the knowingly performed language does not save this instruction in any way. And in fact, Justice Brennan addressed that very argument in Sandstrom and rejected it. And that's on page 514 of the Sandstrom decision. and I just very briefly wanted to touch on preservation. I know you're talking about plain error analysis, but when you read the court's overruling of the objection to the final paragraph, which is the paragraph that encompassed this language, please look very carefully at the language of the court that says there's been an objection to inferences that can be made. And I think that includes the presumed intent language here, because whereas there is certainly a difference between a presumption and an inference to be made, that's my whole argument, right? The court didn't recognize that distinction and was including that in the overruling of that objection. So the court was on notice of the objection to the specific language. Thank you very much.
Ms. Jeffrey. And thank you, Ms. Friedman. On behalf of the court, I want to thank both of you for superb oral arguments. This is a most difficult case, and you really acquitted yourselves and your offices extremely well. And we very much appreciate it. Also, as I did before, I want to thank you for your obvious professionalism. It means a lot to all of us in the profession. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course, and counsel is excused. Thank you very much.